So what I'm showing here is the an interactive coding duel using pigs for fun. And it has a number of puzzles preloaded, and the task is to guess a hidden implementation. So this one is a puzzle that takes a string and returns a character, and we can run this against the hidden implementation and then check whether we have guessed the hidden, the secret program. So the secret program returns the empty string, the character zero, not, with the input, the empty string, we just return the constant A. So we could, for example, given these discrepancies between ours and the sequent implementation, we might guess that it's something that returns either the first or the last character of the string, and if the string is empty, probably returns the null character. And you can try this online, so when you get bored during the talk, you have something better to do. right, so let's go on to the main topic of the talk, which is I would like to present topics around the group I'm at in research on software engineering, our research and tools. And in fact, I will come back to a website that's very similar to the Pigs for Fun that showcases some of our research. So here's a summary of the Microsoft Research Labs around the world. So I'm from the Redmond Lab, and comparison with Microsoft as a whole, we are a fairly small fraction, about 1% of the workforce works in the Microsoft research area. So the R&D organization, where most of, you are from, is about estimated 40,000 of Microsoft, and sales support marketing is another 50,000. Roughly. If you visit the main campus in March, you'll have a chance to go to the Tech Fest. It's an internal event for Blue Badge only. It looks more or less like this on a crowded corridor. And you can the researchers have the green jerseys. They're showcasing their projects, and you can see that there are one, two, or three researchers in each booth, and that's very symptomatic of many of the research projects. They're put together as research projects are created, and we build prototypes around these research projects. We form other groups and collaborations according to the ideas we try out. We cover several main research areas that are listed here. So it ranges from biology to security and gaming. And so I'm from the software engineering, the second to last area. Did any see? Is anybody familiar with Boku Kuru? Okay, one. So I'll give. So this is a programming environment that is geared towards that works well with the Xbox controller, and it's geared towards teaching introductory programming, game programming. So here you see a program. It's a set of guarded commands. So you have a guard conditions, and when the guard condition holds, you can take the effect. And online there's a demo, short demo of Boku, and let's see if the sound is on. So it comes with a sound. Okay, I'll maybe turn it off so you can hear my beautiful voice instead. So what you see here is a run-through of a programming session with Boku, and it gives you a graphical interface to tell you what are the possible combinations of guard conditions and side effects, actions that that are compatible. And the task is to program the little Boku. I think it's called the Boku that moves around in a area. And you can download this. So this came out of the Fuse Lab in Redmond, and you can download it on the PC or on the Xbox. So if you have an urge to program your Xbox using this environment, I welcome you. Here's another example, quite different, of a research project called Show. In this demo, he's using Sho to navigate the Active Directory infrastructure and display information about the Active Directory. So you here have the address book in Active Directory. So Sho is a set of managed DLLs that you can run within Python. So here you see the Python shell. And that gives you a convenient way to do scientific programming. It comes out of the machine learning and data mining groups in Redmond. I'll turn on this sound again. So one of the projects we that's coming out this spring from research is a SDK for the Kinect. And here you see Jonathan Fay at MIX 11 demonstrate his worldwide telescope hooked up with Kinect. And he's going into the future in 2017 to look at a solar eclipse that's going to cover most of North America at that time, so we can preview the eclipse. And you can see that he's navigating the through space using the Kinect SDK. So this is one of the this is not a smaller research project, but it's an example of one of the more systemic, larger research and development projects that is coming out of Microsoft Research fairly soon, actually. And now to my home turf. Here's a Nikolai Tillman and Michael Moskal from the RISE group, where I'm. And they're talking about their recent project called Touch Studio, and I'll go into some more depth into Touch Studio later in this talk. It's an environment for programming the phone on the phone, and there we are tackling, you know, how can you make it easy to write script-like programs on the go on the phone. And it turns out to be pretty, pretty both very fun and quite powerful, I would say. All right, so let's drill down into the Redmond Lab, and in particular the research in software engineering group that I would like to introduce you to. So it's a group of around 30 researchers, and so here's a more or less recent picture of us. So what are we about? We are about improving software development productivity. Research has a big interaction with academia, and as part of this interaction, we host a large number of summer interns every year. And so the summer is buzzing from May to September with academic interns. These are mostly graduate students in their PhD, first, second, and third year PhDs. And it's a very appealing place to come for academic interns, for academic internships. They work then on projects with us, and it's a big boost to our research I'd say. Back to what is research in software engineering about. So on one hand, the goals of our research is about improving various aspects of writing code. So one is how to maintain code. What's the energy consumption of code in a data center? Can you predict the way that software works? How can you analyze the code? What's the reliability of the software? But where do we come from? We come from we use a set of core competencies in software engineering to tackle these problems. And these are the goodies you learn in school: logic, automata, statistics, semantics, type systems of programs. So on top of these core competencies, we build on a number of basic tools. So we have one tool called Boogie that helps to for verifying code. Another tool is a so-called a theorem prover. It's called a satisfiability model theory solver. It's called Z3, and that's my tool. There's a we have a web client platform, and then we for experimental experimentation, and then there's a compiler runtime infrastructure. So this includes the common compiler infrastructure that helps you write compilers for various mainly managed language artifacts, compilers and analysis tools, that is. And then we have extensions on .NET Reflection called Extended Reflection. And these tools are then used in the various projects that aim for the benefits we. Class of projects can be categorized as code analysis. So, for example, one of them is the unit testing framework called PEX that I just showed you, the PEX for Fun demo coding duel. So that gives a flavor of what you can do with PEX. But there's several other projects in the code analysis. So this is an area where our group is quite strong in. Then another area is runtimes and optimization. So we look at how to write compilers or how to write runtimes on say JavaScript is a hot topic. Now also a main area is modeling, synthesis, and verification of systems. So that goes into the reliability and analyzing systems for correctness. So for example, in one project, we built a verifying C compiler that can be used for proving properties of C code. So if you have some very precious highly exposed piece of C code, say a hypervisor, you can use VCC for analyzing this. So we took about 30,000 lines of the hypervisor were verified. The Viridian hypervisor were verified using VCC. So we verify that the hypervisor simulates a piece of hardware. So the purpose of a hypervisor is to act or pretend that it is the hardware for the guest operating systems. We also have projects in analytics, so in mining code repositories. So whenever you make a check-in, there's some manifests some code churn, and there's a question of every time you fix a bug, you may introduce another bug or other two bugs. And so can you look at a set of check-ins from a bigger group and then predict how well the code will fare in the field as it gets released? And so we have prediction tools called Crane for making such assessments. So they use statistical methods. As I said, we have around 30 members, and also, to repeat, the main mode of work in research is we build groups of one, two, or three people, depending on projects. So it's a fairly dynamic mode of matching projects with collaborations. And to elaborate, our mission is to improve the development of productivity by better software engineering, programming languages, and foundations. So there's a mix of competencies that come into place in what we aim for. We get measured in quite differently from product environments. So we don't ship, we don't create revenue. So what does Microsoft Research do? Our mission, our foremost mission is to advance science. We also expected of helping academia. So a big part of our work is academic service. And but luckily we are an industrial research lab, and it shouldn't be a very important part is impacting the Microsoft and developers with Microsoft. So in these three prongs, we develop tools and create impact. For example, in the context of Microsoft, we influence the design of .NET. We create security testing of media readers that go into browsers for preventing attacks. Advancing science is quite a span of different efforts. So one advance was proving the Turing thesis from axioms. So here the question is, what is computable? So Yuri Gurevich came up with a set of axioms that characterized what can be computed, and then proved from these axioms that Church's thesis was true. So this is fairly mathematical and highly abstract, but other advances deal, for example, with can we verify a piece of operating system software? Can we model check? Can we find concurrency bugs in software using probabilistic guarantees? And so on. In our academic service, we organize conferences and workshops. We also, as part of big part of our work, is tool building. Here's a picture of several of the tools we develop in RISE. So at the bottom, you see some of the core infrastructure tools. Z3 is my theorem prover. There's AGL is a automatic graph layout library, and CCI is the common compiler infrastructure. And on top of that, we have several analysis tools or tools for helping software in developing software. And you can try these, many of these tools you can try out online. I will glance through a few of these tools later. Our core expertise can be characterized roughly in four areas here. So one is empirical software engineering, as in the Crane tool. Another is logical foundations. A third one is automating analysis of software. And fourthly, how to construct software. Can we develop programming languages or methodologies for designing software. So sample questions in each of these areas can be, what is the risk of shipping this code? And for that, there's a tool called Crane that helps you assessing that risk. In the context of logical foundations, we ask whether formulas are satisfiable. And these formulas come out from analyzing software. When you write a program analysis tool, they often ask these questions. They boil down to logical questions. Is it possible that x squared is less than zero, for example? Is that feasible? So we have a tool called Z3 for that. In software analysis, a sample question is, what's the running time? What's the worst case running time of running this code? Is my sorting algorithm, is it n log n or n squared, or is it even worse? So there's a tool called Speed that can analyze source code and come up with a runtime estimate, a worst case a runtime estimate for this code. In context of developing software, you can ask, how can I write and analyze models and their composition of software? And there's a tool, Formula, for this. Now to the Touch Studio project. So this is another project, not one of those fours, but this one is about programming in the age of Facebook. So in the Stone Age, so we're apparently even if you're 30 years old, you're apparently old enough, at least if you were a geek when you were a small kid, to have had one of these computers, but not one of these. And the first thing you did as a geek was to write a program on one of these computers to print Hello World on the console. The reality of phones is that has so far been that to program them, you program them in a software development kit on the PC or then publish the programs to a marketplace or transfer them otherwise if you have a development license. You have not had direct access to customizing these devices. On the other hand, they have access to really fancy graphics engines and other features. So one question, can we revive some of the joy we had as geeky kids on the Commodore to the portable device? And what does it mean? So it means something quite different now, which I'll go into. So for this, we have a project called Touch Studio that was released April 9th, a little bit more than a month ago, to the marketplace. And we're now preparing version 1.3 beta of it. And this is how it looks like. When you open the app, you can start code. That gives you access to a set of APIs. Here's the API that accesses the media of the phone. So you can access the picture library. You can choose a picture from the library. You can add pictures. You can access the playlist as well. You can then add scripts that are then accessible through a tiling interface. So when you click on one of these tiles, you can then get access to the scripts that are stored under the tiles. So it looks like as if you have an app, but in reality it's a script that you can customize. So here's a sample script. that illustrates fairly well a large usage scenario, which is I want to find songs that are no longer than 3 minutes in my song collection, and then have access to those. So script for that, it takes each song in the list of songs that you have on your device, and then checks whether the duration of the song is less than 180 seconds, and then posts that song to a wall. So a set of very simple commands, a sequence of them, gives you the power to access common functionality that are interesting for the phone. So how do you write these scripts? Well, for that we developed an editor that you can use even with fairly big thumbs. And so this is how the editor looks like. You can zoom in on a line and then start editing it. You can cut or you can paste lines before and after. So here's a zoom in of the post to wall being edited, and then the editor gives you an IntelliSense style menu. It basically looks at the type of song, and then tells you what are the possible methods on the song object. The language is a simple procedural language, so you have if-then-else statements, you can assignment and simple loops. That's it. As alluded before, so what's the problem space here? Is programming in the age of the cloud or Facebook? What I'm showing here on the right is a demo of a park and find application. So here's the park script. It's very simple. You take a picture and it senses the location of where you took the picture. When you then later want to find your car, you run this script, which retrieves back the location that was stored globally, posts the location on a map, and posts the picture of the car you parked. And in this particular case, I parked the car on the Olympic Peninsula when going digging for geoducks with some friends, and I took the and I then ran the find program when I was back in Bellevue. So there's quite a while back to the car. Hopefully, when you park your car, you are fairly close to it when you need to find it. But it illustrates different interaction with different services. So you have a mapping service, a GPS service. You have access to the picture, the camera, and in a few lines, these scripts put together these facilities. So that's what we are aiming for, making it scriptable. We hope to cover teenagers and Excel macro writers, everybody else. This demo illustrates the graphical engine interaction. You have two pieces of the screen, and you can activate one or the other, but not both, for bouncing these balls around. Now I'm going to show the script that just did that little game. And as you can see, it's a very small script again. And I will go a little bit more, give a little bit more flavor of the way that we propose making scripts for gaming easy. So what are the challenges, we believe? So the first one is, how do you make it easy to code on a phone with with just a few touches. It's immensely more challenging than using a full-fledged keyboard where you have good editors for it. You cannot import a traditional editor to that environment. Many of the operations are also asynchronous. So so how do you make programming with these asynchronous services accessible? There's and those are often in the cloud. Let's make that easy. One thing we're working on is sharing these scripts. So our current release doesn't let you share scripts, and this is one obvious feedback. Well, I wrote a script. Can I get your script without retyping it? Currently, you can post your scripts to Facebook, and there's a Facebook page where you can see some scripts being shared, and they're pretty fun. How do you debug these applications? I have a demo here, and it's one that I'm particularly proud of because it's a script that I wrote. Now you can see that the graphics is not very fancy on it. It's a program for learning the digits of pi, and so you enter the digits of pi one by one, so 3, 1. And now I entered 7. Oh, that's wrong. So let me enter 4 again. Okay, so 3, 1, 4, 1, and so on. I wrote this script because a couple of years ago, my daughter had a competition in her school. She was they were seeing who could learn the most digits of pi, so she learned 240 digits. And so I felt a bit envious, so let's see if I could learn more than 4 digits of pi myself. So this is actually a script that generates the first 800 digits of pi, and this is the core of the script. And if anybody can see that you actually get 800 digits of pi from this core, I would be very impressed. So it's a so-called spigot algorithm that generates digits incrementally. But it can be written in a very concise way and even on the phone. So as I promised, as the main theme here is how do we make scripting for the phone, on the phone, easy and accessible, and one part is the graphics engine. So Manuel Fendrich developed the graphics engine that where I gave the demo with the two parts of the screen. And in this context, he identified a couple of basic primitives. So it's centered around a game board, and so you create a game board of a certain size in the script. And then you post the board to a wall, and the game loop is essentially a while loop that where you read senses and then update the board on the wall. On the board, you manipulate objects. So objects on the board are called sprites. So here's an example script where you create a ball. It's an ellipse of diameter or height and width 20. So it's a circle, and there's also an obstacle on the board. So now you can have a little a ball bouncing around the board, according to how you accelerate, move the phone, you can move the ball in and out of the obstacle. And then there's a few other concepts that are used for this graphics programming, besides obstacles interacting with touch and the physics engine. So here's an example of a ninja program that Manuel wrote. And this, I'm going to illustrate how these can be how these scripts can be customized very simply. So the ninja program is something you have a dagger, you're going to throw that against a target. And the ninja had, the head was all filled out in this example of the game. But I don't like that look of the ninja, so I'm going to change that in the script, where I draw the ellipse. That's not going to be the ellipse. So you click, hit the code twice, and then you can start editing it. So I'm going to change the fill factor of the head in here, and see how you can use the editor how interacting with the editor is. Then I'm going to rerun the game, and now you see the ninja has an empty head. So what is this? So it's basically to give you a flavor of, you can update these scripts, customize them in a very fine level of granularity. Okay, so that's for the recent project on Touch Studio. I want to give you some overview of some other projects that we have in RISE. And these are accessible from the RISE for Fun webpage, so you can go online and try them out. And they give you some overview of different kinds of research we do. So one was the PEX program exploration that I showed in the beginning. Another project is automatic graph layout, and this may be interesting in a quite different context. So there are many groups that use the AGL, automatic graph layout library. The recent work on AGL has been on drawing graphs nicely aesthetically. For example, you can bundle edges. these two are the same graphs, but with edge bundling, you get a much more concise view of the graph. Now, when edges cross, and you zoom in on the crossing, there are nice and not so nice ways of drawing it. So another thing that we work on is edge cross, making edge crossover nice. If you have hierarchical graphs, you can group nodes in hierarchies, and so that's another thing you can do with AGL, and you can also try it online here. So it's completely different project is exploring regular expressions, and in this context we're interested in checking. Comparing two regular expressions, is one regular expression a subset of the other, or do they denote the same language? This kind of test can be recast as a game. So there are online demo of the regular expression explorer tool. Is a little game. You give there's a secret regular expression, and you check whether. You can guess the secret regular expression. In extension to this, there's a web sanitizer tool called Beck, and it helps you doing security analysis using symbolic transducers. So here the context is web sanitizers. So if you have a web front end, that takes strings from clients and use these strings to query databases, you can inject SQL attacks. If you use strings that have hidden side or unintended side effects. So what you can do to avoid these side effects is to sanitize the strings that come in. So a sanitizer maps a string to another string. And you can write these as so-called string transducers. And here we can then analyze the string transducers for whether they really sanitize the strings. So the BEC tool will check whether the string sanitizer has completely sanitized all strings after they have been run through. Formula is a modeling tool, so we can, so for example, configurations, you can model sets of, so one application of Formula is in analyzing and developing configuration spaces. It comes from actually embedded systems development. So here's an example of using Formula for describing a embedded system, a set of embedded system designs, and then that set of designs has many different incarnations, many different possible solutions that are legal, and this tool will explore the space of different legal solutions. Code contracts. Actually, let's do a demo of this. So here's the apps function. So can anybody tell me what it does? Yes? Yes? So you say it returns a non-negative number?
Yeah.
Okay, so at least that's what it advertises. But the advertisement is not right, because if you pass in a min value of in 32, that's going to be less than zero, but if you say minus min value, you get min value back. The point of the contract tool is to, you can add assertions as pre and post conditions to your code. So this one is a ensures assertion, and it says about whenever the function returns, there's a property of the return value, namely that the result should be non-negative. But that contract is not right for this function, so too bad, right? But in general, it can check. Let's see various contracts. So here was another contract that. Another piece of code that had where the option value was not accessed correctly. So the contract tool can be used to statically find these kinds of bugs. Finally, we have the verifying C compiler, as I mentioned, So if you have high integrity code in C, you can use this tool for it. It's as you can see, it's not for the average development cycle, because you will annotate the code quite heavily. Okay, I want to give a short introduction to my own research, which is on the efficient SMT solver. So it's used in most of the tools that I showed you as a core technology. So it's developed with me and Leonardo De Mura on the picture. And our quest is essentially solving the intractable. So intractable is that logical constraints languages, they capture very nicely what programs mean, and that's great for program analysis. But in capturing these, the meaning, they're quite powerful. So reasoning about it to solve these formulas is highly intractable. So for example, if you do an encoding using propositional logic. Propositional logic satisfiability is NP complete, so that's known as intractable. There's no known polynomial time algorithms for these. But there are other formalisms that are much more powerful and succinct than just Boolean encoding. And it gets more and more appealing to use these good encodings, because they allow you to write very succinct, small, compact encodings. But then the reasoning of them is the challenge. So that's what my research is about in a nutshell. So to find algorithms that have four problems of high complexity, but develop these algorithms for practical settings, such as that what we find in program analysis. So there's been a lot of progress in scaling these algorithms in the latest years. So what is SMT? In a nutshell, if you have formula, is it satisfiable modulo a theory T? So what's a theory? It's an arithmetic. And the solvers have specialized algorithms for these theories. So here's an example of a formula, and it says if x plus 2 is y, then f of read, write equals f of y minus x plus 1. So these are so-called array operations. It's like if you have a map. And this formula is true under the theories that are used. So one theory is arithmetic. So here we have arithmetical plus and minus and the constants. So we need to reason about, know what it means, what's the meaning of plus to say whether this statement is true or not. And as I said, there's also the array theory. So the array theory is a device that's useful for modeling a heap in programs. And the properties of arrays are that if you update an array at a position I with a value v, and you read back I, then you get v back. But if you read at a position that you did not update, so a position j that's different from the I, then what you get back is what you originally had in the array before the update. And f is an uninterpreted function, so it's some function that we don't care about what's behind it. This is true no matter what f is. So one example of SMT solving is job shop scheduling. So if you can have a set of machines and a set of jobs, the task in job shop scheduling is to run these jobs on each machine in a given order, but two jobs cannot run at the same time on a given machine. So, as I said, you have different tasks of a given job, and then a precedence order on the jobs. And then each machine can only run one job at a time. And you can formulate this in logic. So this is how it's formulated in logic, these precedence and resource constraints. So the precedence constraint is, well, if we for each job you have a start time and a duration, then we just say that the start time of the task number 2, 3 after the duration of it is before the start time of the next task. And then the resource constraint is a disjunction. So this is a so-called non-convex constraint, so you can't use convex optimization for this. And now you can encode this as a formula, and this is what the SMT solver can solve for you. You can solve for finding an allocation of jobs to machines using this. We're quickly running out of time. I'll present three more slides on to give an idea of what progress has been made in this area of theorem proving. And it's actually quite exciting times for this these kinds of technologies. One way to divide of what's going on in the research community is that you there's work on purely propositional satisfiability solving. So here's a propositional formula that says you can either have a tie or a shirt, or you can not have a tie or not have a shirt, or you can have not a tie or a shirt. So the only what is ruled out is that if you have a tie but not a shirt, right? So it would be silly to have a tie but not a shirt on. In first order theorem proving has been geared towards problems in universal algebra, so what you learn in group theory. So these are axioms about group theory. So it's appealed a lot to mathematicians. The SMT solvers, as I gave some flavor of, has appealed to, has been built around analyzing programs. So they mix things, terminology that you find in program analysis. But the progress has been tremendous over the last, this is just over the last decade. So there are lots of recent milestone in SAT solving. So problems that were, so this is a graph that shows the fastest solvers across time from 2002 to last year on a set of benchmarks, 180 benchmarks. And so the fastest solver in 2002 could handle about 40 benchmarks until it timed out. Now, the fastest solver today will do the first 45, 50 problems in a few seconds. So it's amazing what progress has been made in handling really, really large constraints. So these have millions of variables, and they come from hardware designs. First-order theorem proving has a long and proud tradition from dating back to the 1930s and has been maybe suffered from my point of view, looking at mathematical problems, has been looking at small intricate theorems that have interest for algebraists. More recently, they're looking at ontologies that come from knowledge-based systems. And that has given rise to solving very large problems, instances, and develop theory for algorithms for that. In the context of SMT, we have also quite a bit of recent progress, and thanks to a good use of that in program analysis tools. Okay, I will stop here. I think we're essentially gone for a good time now. And I wonder, could we get some questions or... Yes? That would be great. We have some colleagues in Spain who, I should say that C3 is the bragging rights is that this is the fastest SMT solver around. So there's a number of research groups that work on SMT solvers. So one of them is in Spain, and they have specialized in using their methods for scheduling problems. So it basically depends on which users we have. And I would be very interested to hear what you have. Other questions?
I have a question.
Yes?
Could you tell us more about this tool you named called Crane?
The Crane?
You mentioned the tool called Crane.
Yes. So Crane is developed in the empirical software engineering subgroup of RISE. And so they look at they develop statistical models of of your check-in, your code check-ins. So they go to Source Depot and mine the data that comes from Source Depot or TFS, they can then look at historical data from previous releases that correlate. So they look for correlations between churn rate, say the depth of method calls in code, whether teams are distributed or local, whether developers has had previous releases. I mean, how what's the age of the development team, and many other very diverse set of measurable factors, and then develop prediction models for, say, how many bugs will be reported in the field given a code release. When will this code be ready for shipping? When will the bug rates basically go down? I was a developer in the file systems group 5 years ago, and from 2002 to 2006. So one reaction to these analyses is that you sort of know. If you're in the team, you may know. But if you have a bird's eye view of what's going on, you wouldn't know yourself. And these tools essentially reaffirm what maybe some individuals would know or some developers. But they can help, say, a management chain for added diligence during code release. All right. Well, thank you.